Money FM 89.3, the best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Okay, let's help you get that regular income stream set up with a healthy portfolio of dividend stocks. Now, classic dividend stocks are stocks of companies that have a history of paying dividends consistently to their shareholders over time. They're usually well-established, they have a track record of generating steady profits and cash flows, and they operate often in mature industries, right, with stable customer demand that allows them to generate these reliable earnings. Some classic examples that come to mind, maybe Coca-Cola, Johnson & Johnson, companies that have been paying dividends over several years, and they have a reputation for reliability when it comes to income generators. So how can you think through a process of assessing a company and figuring out if it could fall in the dividend stock potential category, especially if we're talking about a digital disruptor for traditional services that banks provide? And that example was shared by a regular listener of this show. Thank you so much. At the end of the show, we'll share how you can send us your questions and your thoughts as well. This is Money and Me, and now we turn the mic over to DT for an extended conversation with the dividend titan himself, Willie King, back with us in the studio. How are you doing, Willie?
Hey, Michelle. I just got a nice cup of coffee, so I'm back in the studio again. And, you know, I always love having, you know, myself on the show. You know, it's such a joy. Thanks for inviting me again.
It is. Always great to speak with you. I've always wanted to know, why did you call your company Dividend, your blog Dividend, Dividend Titan?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question, Michelle. So the thing when I started out the blog, when I wanted to write about stocks, dividends came into my mind because I felt that the best strategy which I had was actually dividend investing, because I tried a lot of different strategies and a lot of them didn't really turn out well. So things like your special situations, your turnarounds, I mean, they make good money, but it was very tiring. And sometimes you win, you know, good money, but you also lose a lot as well. And then I realized that after that, you know, I started to look at dividend stocks when, you know, back a couple of years back, I think in 2013 or 2014, when interest rates, there was the scale of interest rates and REITs started dropping, banks started falling. And I wanted to actually put some money because I lost money from my mom, and I told her I wanted a more stable strategy. So I tried dividend stocks.
Woo! What did mom think after the loss?
Well, so after that, then, you know, things started to go more steady. The market recovered. And then the income started coming in. I say, hey, this looks something interesting.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for sharing the history of Dividend Titan with us. All right, we're starting with a couple of stock picks and stock ideas. Capital and Investments share price has been falling. Why are we talking about this first up? So down more than 9% since February. Headquartered and listed right here in Singapore, very familiar name, Capital Land Investment, a leading global real estate investment manager. Why has this stock made your list today?
Very interestingly, the shares actually fell 9% since last month in February because of sort of a weaker result. But before I get into that, the thing I like about Capital Land Investment is that, you know, it's sort of a sleep soundly at night kind of dividend play, even though it's only at 3.3%. But all this income is actually backed by very solid property assets. So if you imagine about this, you know, having a portfolio of different assets and filling these assets with different tenants, and these tenants paying rental income. But what's more incredible is that, you know, you don't just own one of these assets, you own assets from different businesses, different industries. And that's what Capital Land Investment really does, right? They do own one of the six blue chip REITs, which includes your Capital Land Integrated Commercial Trust, your Ascott Trust, your Ascenders REIT as well, and alongside the three others, including CapitaLand Malaysia. So all this pays really good dividends, and this really contributes to a very stable stream of stable income. Now, the issue comes when they published their latest full-year financial results last year, which came out in the month of February. And the problem is that while they have a very stable income stream coming from the REITs, coming from managing some of these REIT assets, the problem comes when they actually sold off JQ. They sold off, you know, a smaller number of assets in China, because the other side, because Capital Investment, they actually runs on two different profit engines, right? Your fee income business and your real estate investment business. So this real estate investment business, what they do, right, it's a lot like a hamster wheel. you invest money into a fund, you get investors to invest money into the fund, you develop this fund which invests into different property projects, and when it is ready, you sell it off for a profit. So last year, they didn't sell as much as it was the previous year. And as a result, their profits actually dropped. And that's why the market didn't take it too well. Shares actually fell 9%. So the volatile side of the business, or the cyclical side of the business, hasn't really been doing well. Although management says that, hey, that's actually part of our target. You know, they didn't really expect to actually divest as much because a lot of their projects and funds are in China. So because of the China lockdown last year, they didn't really manage to sell a lot of assets. The volume of the assets which they sold have actually dropped.
Yeah, so the volatility comes when you think about the asset recycling, the rental rebates that were extended to retail tenants in China as well. And if you look at the divested properties in Japan, Singapore and China, whether there were significant contributions there or lack of, right? Now, looking at the stock is, I think the earnings fell 32% in its latest results, right?
Yes.
So what is next for Capital Investment Shares moving forward?
Yep. Very good point, Michelle. So usually if you see Capital Investment Shares, historically they trace off like a cycle. So they picked out, you know, at $4 per share three times before they actually reorganized from CapitaLand Limited last time. And the reason why all this have this peak and trough cycle is really a lot on the capital cycles, the divestments of their assets. So when there's good time, when they actually sold off very good amount of assets, share price typically goes up. When they typically have a lower number of divestment volumes, the share price will actually drop. So it's more of a cyclical play here, but you have that stable income component. So right from here, as we are looking at a China reopening, a more relaxation of the China regulations on the tech clampdown, we could possibly see a Chinese economy recovery, and this could be a tailwind for CapitaLand Investment. So even though they have a 3.3% dividend yield, I mean, this excludes the special dividends which they paid last year, it could seem like a pretty comfortable income for people who like something stable and they just don't want to stress overnight.
Again, a very important point on China, since 36%, it has 36% exposure to the China market. Now, here's a question for you. Do you consider CLI a defensive dividend player?
Absolutely, because of that component of fee income. So despite people saying that it's a cyclical play, but what's interesting is that when I look at CapitaLand Investment, my thinking is that, hey, this is something which I possibly can trust because CapitaLand has been around for the longest time. It is also owned by Temasek Holdings. So that have a they have a very strong sponsorship, which means that when it comes to project pipelines, injection of assets, the creation and development of projects, you know, CapitaLand will always be at the forefront of all these new profitable projects. And on top of that, if you see the underlying REITs which they own and manage, they're all blue chip REITs. So this pay out really good income, really good dividends. But on top of that, they also collect a management fee. So whether there is interest rates going up, whether interest rates going down, whether the REITs are not doing well, the REIT still has to pay the fees to CapitaLand Investment.
When we look at the broader macroeconomic environment, are there any other significant drivers that could contribute to CLI's growth or could be risk factors for the rest of this year?
I guess interest rates could also come at one point because of the borrowing costs of these projects. So even though CapitaLand doesn't put in the full amount of working capital or construction loans, they go in as an equity player or a stock investor together with other investors. But the projects which they manage, you know, they do also have to actually borrow money to actually develop some of these property projects. And as interest rates go up, this could actually be more costly or more expensive to develop some of these projects. And that could actually reduce the profits or the gains coming out from these properties.
Very fair overview there. All right, so we've been looking at CapitaLand Investment, and now we switch over to IREIT Global. I'm sure that's a very familiar name for many of you. It is Singapore's first listed real estate investment trust. Shares of IREIT Global down more than 38% since its IPO back in 2014. Why has it made your list?
This is a dividend yield, it has a dividend yield of about 7.8%. And just a disclaimer, I do own shares in my portfolio for IREIT Global.
Now, thanks for sharing.
Why has it caught my attention is because this is a very simple REIT to understand. You know, there's no complex mergers, there's no complex income support agreements when they got listed in 2014. So what do I mean by this is a lot of times as investors, you want to watch out for what I call income support. This means that when a REIT goes public, when they get listed, sometimes the sponsor would actually perform what I call a rental guarantee. This helps to artificially boost the yield when the IPO to make it seem like it's a very attractive yield for investors when it comes to the IPO. So there are some cases which happen, say for example, Keppel REIT did have an income support back then in order to boost the yield when the IPO. But for IREIT Global, even though that they are a slightly smaller Singapore REIT, their properties held up on its own, right? They have a very, very strong occupancy rate for IREIT Global. Except last year, one of their German properties, their tenant, Deutsche Telekom, has exited from the properties. That's why their occupancy rate dropped from about more than 90% to about 88%. But if you think about it, they did mention, management did mention that a lot of potential tenants are already looking to fill in their spot. So they only vacated, Deutsche Telekom only vacated November last year. Today we are in March. That's why the reporting came out saying that the occupancy rate has dropped about 88%. But if you ask me if I'm concerned, not really, because they did actually say, or they did actually highlight that there are already tenants lining up to actually fill in the spot.
Were you on the latest call, 23rd February, when the IREIT Global discuss their latest financial results? Any insights from that call?
So while I didn't go onto the call, but what I like to do is I prefer to read the annual reports because it's much faster. And sometimes, you know, with my kids around, sometimes it's very difficult to go onto the call attentively. But I do read the financial statements. And one thing which they actually highlighted, which I like, is their financial position. So what do I mean by this is they don't have any borrowings which are coming up over the next 2 to 3 years. I think the next big one is in 2026, which means if, let's say, our good friends over in the US continues to pump rates up, IREIT Global is sort of safe in that nice safe haven from rising interest rates. And at the same time, you know, their borrowing cost is pretty cheap at this point. I think they're only paying about 1%+, which means that their interest cover is high. It's about 7 to 8 times. So interest cover is basically the amount of rental income they collect, or the net property income which they have, and which covers the amount of interest which they actually have to pay. So the higher the interest cover, the better. So for IREIT Global, it's roughly about 7 to 8 times. Mm-hmm. To put into perspective, our granddaddy of Singapore REITs, Capital Land Integrated Commercial Trust, interest coverage ratio is roughly about 4 times. So it's actually much more healthy than our blue chip, our granddaddy blue chip here.
Fantastic. So, Go ahead.
So there, one thing which I like, which we talk about, crown jewels. Their crown jewel is actually the German offices. So they do have an inbuilt rental escalation that's tied to the CPI. So this is something which I do look out for. So you can expect the DPU to sort of gradually increase or at least stay stable.
I have to play devil's advocate because that is what I do. So Europe's property sector is said to be facing headwinds with a recession happening this year, possibly. How do you think this could shape up in terms of headwinds for IREIT Global?
So one thing about IREIT Global is that they have a particular property, which is their Spanish property. I think that has sort of come into the headwinds of the European economy. Yeah. And they have very low occupancy rates. So they haven't really tried to fill in some of this occupancy. So I think what IREIT does here is, you know, they try to diversify their assets, not just in one country, but they also diversify across the tenants. So they do pick quality tenants here. Say, for example, one of their French properties has been leased out to one of the big French retailers, Decathlon. So these are all very highly, this is a highly profitable conglomerate, which, you know, have pretty strong cash flow. So the ability to actually pay a steady flow of income is pretty high. So this is something which I REIT can actually look forward to. And at least, you know, coming from a bottom-up point of view, it helps to shield away from the headwinds which might actually happen in Europe.
Because of that diversification factor.
Exactly.
You're looking at 27 retail properties in France, 5 office assets in Spain, and 5 office properties in Germany.
Mm.
Last I checked. All right, you are on Money and Me. I'm Michelle Martin. He's Willie King, otherwise known as the Dividend Titan himself. All right, let's take a look at VTech Holdings now, also making the list. They are a leader in electronic learning products from infancy all the way to your little grown-up toddler in preschool. They also manufacture residential phones in the US. Very interesting company. Their latest results, little bit of a disappointment. The company has issued a profit warning. Its profits may drop 15 to 20% because of what's going on in the US and Europe as well. Help us understand this particular company, a global leader in electronic infant and toddler projects. Given their profit warning, is this a big red flag?
Mm. So this is actually a surprise for me. I'll just jump straight into their latest results first. I mean, VTech's latest results was a real disappointment. Mm. Company issued a profit warning saying that they might actually drop their profits by 15 to 20% because of the US and Europe macro situation. Now, to give things in context, VTech basically sells your electronic learning products. So if you walk into Toys R Us today, you'll definitely see one of VTech's products, which is your LeapFrog learning products for toddlers. So I buy, to be honest, Michelle, I do buy a couple of stuff there, and they are really expensive. You know, they're priced $30 to $50 for some of these products.
Ooh.
But people still pay for them because of the quality and because it's safe for small kids. But anyway, because for VTech, they actually ship all this not just to in Asia, but they also sell to Europe and the US. And if you recall, some time back, there was this huge US-China tariffs and geopolitical tensions. So this actually caused a weakness in their profitability, and that actually affected VTech itself. Now, when it comes to investing, I always like to see, not just from the geopolitical standpoint, but whether their products are still able to capture the attention of consumers. And I believe that for VTech, it does, because if you see, their toys are still doing pretty well. They have also started selling their toys on Amazon as well, on the e-commerce. So they are shifting not just from offline to online. The problem is, right now, the shares have been affected by the macro situation. And on top of that, the things which have been also hitting VTech are its recent supply chain disruptions, because VTech does ship a lot of these products out of China into the US and Europe. And because of the supply chain disruption, they're faced with higher shipping costs, higher raw material costs, and because of the shortage in semiconductors, plus COVID, and also the weakness in the Hong Kong stock market. That's why their shares haven't really been performing right now. But what I like about VTech here is really that it is a sort of a what I call a capital efficient machine. And it has that rocket fuel to push itself out of this sort of list of bad events. Because if you see in detail in the balance sheet, they do have a very high what I call return on equity, which is a representation of the rocket fuel of a company. So return on equity is the amount of profits which shareholders can stand to gain for every, say, $100 they put in. So $100 they put in, how much they can get back is their ROE. So the higher the ROE, the better it is.
It's
for
about
VTech.
27%.
Yes, exactly.
Right, expected. That's amazing. Mm. So what do you make of how VTech is reinvesting its profits?
Mm. So that's the interesting thing, because it is a capital efficient business, and right now it doesn't need to actually invest a lot in new plants or equipment. If you see, their capital expenses is minimal. They are not really capital intensive, because they outsource most of their manufacturing to their other suppliers, which means that they are able to actually pay out all these excess returns as dividends to their shareholders. So there's two camps here, Michelle. One camp is that people do not like VTech because they actually pay out most of their profits as dividends. So that leaves very little room to reinvest into the business. But on the other side, people who like, you know, high income and a good yield, and they don't mind actually collecting most of the profits as dividends, just like a REIT, they might like VTech here. So this is how I would see VTech in a, you know, dividend investor's portfolio.
So interesting. So interesting. And we've come now to the part of the show where we're sharing a listener's question. Mm. Deepa Kishnani runs Young Money Managers, and they're a group that spreads financial literacy to young ones here in Singapore. And she wants to know what you think of SoFi. So SoFi Technologies, based in San Francisco, sort of a digital bank. And, you know, we've heard about this banking crisis. And I think it's interesting. How do we actually evaluate if this fintech stock, their ambition, by the way, is to become a top 10 bank. Ooh. They're a digital online bank. They really caught the investments community's attention since their debut back in 2020, since their debut many years back. But last year was a terrible year for it. Ended down 71%. Ooh. But it has been rebounding, and as of March 27th, has beat the NASDAQ composite. So how well-positioned is SoFi in the midst of this banking crisis?
Mm, it's very interesting. SoFi, it's a what I call a small to mid-cap bank, even though its market capitalization is $4 billion, which might seem very big in the Singapore market context, but in the US, it's considered a very small bank. Now, SoFi, just to give a background, they basically lend out personal loans, student loans, a lot of, say, for example, you're lending technology and financial services loans as well. So they're basically a lending platform, or more, what I call, last time what they would call it, a peer-to-peer lending platform, where the loans are really on your personal loans, your student loans, so on and so forth. This is basically what SoFi does. And you can see that they actually have grown really fast because of technology, right? It's very easy to actually put money with SoFi as deposits. And at the same time, you are able to actually borrow money from the bank itself through some of your apps. So they have been investing a lot in technology. They have been investing a lot in their platform. That's why they have actually grown their membership. I think it only started from about 900,000 back in 2019. And today, last check, last quarter, they have about 5.2 million members in their entire community. So this is really huge for SoFi Bank. The growth is huge. Now, how I would evaluate such banks is basically looking at it from a very traditional business model point of view. So I want to be looking at, number one, their liabilities, which makes up of two components. Number one is their deposits, and number two is the borrowings, which they might actually borrow from other banks. Now, for SoFi, they do have a good chunk of their liabilities in deposits, right? They have a fairly strong deposit franchise. But the thing is, they still need to rely on borrowing money from other financial institutions. And that comes from the risk here, because there could be a point or a chance where, let's say, there's another shakeup like Silicon Valley Bank. Depositors might frantically pull out these deposits. Now, don't forget that SoFi Bank, they tend to actually target the younger crowd,
mm-hmm.
which means that in times of a crisis, some of these younger depositors, they might not know about the bank better, and they might frantically just pull all the deposits out, and this might force a bank run on SoFi here.
Interesting view on its depositor base. So what do you make? There's a very famous bull on SoFi, Dan Dale, and he's published a fresh update on SoFi, well known for his Mitsuo Securities prognostication, shall we say. And he's reiterated a recommendation on the stock. I think it's $9 per share price target, and that implies a 56% upside to market price. Quite robust, shall we say. What do you think of that view?
Mm. So the share price right now is really driven by the number of members they can actually grow. So it's not so much about the quality of the deposits, not so much about the balance sheet, and not so much about the profitability, but whether they can actually continue to grow from 5.2 million members, and whether they could actually double or triple or even multifold this member base. And that could be a key driver of the shares. But what could be pulling back the shares could be when the market start to realize that SoFi might not be exactly a profitable bank. Because if you think about it, while their revenues, their income, which they earn from the assets, which they lend out to, personal loans, student loans, so on and so forth,
mm-hmm.
but they do incur very high costs. If you see deeper in the financial statements, they actually incur huge operating costs, such as your platforms. So they need to invest a lot of money to maintain the platforms they have, and also the hiring of their staff, because they do have a huge team of developers behind them supporting these platforms.
Okay, so here's a question from an avid investor, avid young investor who wants to know, could buying shares of this tiny bank stock today be like buying shares of Amazon back in early 2000? Can I turn $10,000 into $3.2 million, Willie?
So this is something, this is always that age-old question, right? Where can you actually 10 times or 100 times your capital for SoFi? Now, if you think about it, you can invest in SoFi and think of it like investing in Amazon. But don't forget the old adage. For every Amazon which has been out there, there are 10,000, 20,000 failures of these technology companies. And sometimes it's very difficult to predict. And as I had an interview with a portfolio manager who invests in US stocks, he did mention that technology tends to change its winds really fast, right? Because the moment you go into the business, there might be disruptions, might actually disrupt your own business model. Yep. There might be other companies or competitors which have a much bigger or much deeper pocket, which can actually outrun you in terms of their spending, their marketing spending, and the ability to acquire customers.
And then there's short sellers as well. Some say that SoFi actually benefited, was insulated from the banking crisis because there was a scathing report from a short seller about Block, which was SoFi's competitor, you know, accusing Block of fraudulent and deceptive practices on the cash app side of the business. And that benefited SoFi in terms of insulating it from negative sentiment. So very interesting viewpoints as always. Thank you so much, Willie, for taking all our questions, including questions from you listeners out there. Keep them coming through. Dan, can you share with our listeners how they can send us questions?
Yeah, you can send us a message via WhatsApp at 8855-0893 and then we'll be able to entertain the questions.
Fantastic. Yeah. All right, Danko there. He's Willie King, Dividend Titan himself. I'm Michelle Martin. Thank you for your company.
Thank you.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.